Good morning. Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFalle. On the show this week, I'll be talking to Lawrence Lessig, professor at the Stanford Law School, and our topic will be forms of property. Lawrence, glad to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
I want to begin, when people think about property, and this is sort of the introduction to this whole sub-series on forms of property, when people think about property, they have a tendency to think of property as if there were a single right to it, that if I have an object, then I own it and I have all the rights with regards to that object. And I take it that lawyers, at least, want to say that that's a misconception. It's a misunderstanding both of the legal relations to property and even the moral relations to property. I wonder if you could say a little bit about why that's so.
Well, of course, in ordinary usage of the term, it's convenient just to think about a property right as an absolute right to control a particular physical object. But lawyers obviously need to think more precisely about what set of rights or bundle of rights one has when one has a property right. And depending on the kind of property at stake, the set of rights that you have are very different. So if you have a house, obviously you have the right to occupy that house. But you don't necessarily have the right to keep people off of the sidewalk in front of the house. You don't necessarily have the right to keep the postman away from the house. You might have to allow access to the house for purposes of checking for the presence of smoke detectors. Any number of these regulations of your rights affects the bundle of rights that you have by virtue of having the house. And the rights that you have by virtue of having the house are different than the rights you might have over your car, or the rights you might have over your diary, or the rights you might have over a piece of property that happens to be located on a sand dune next to the ocean. In each case, the scope of rights that you have in a free society is dependent in many ways upon the public interests that are affected by that property right.
Okay, I know that at least one distinction that lawyers tend to make, or at least some lawyers tend to make, perhaps you don't, is between rights or claim, what are sometimes called claim rights and liberties. Is that a distinction that you feel that it's important to make? And if so, what exactly is the distinction?
Well, I do think it's a distinction that comes mainly to law from philosophy. And lawyers use it only when trying to sketch a general philosophical theory of the nature of property rights. To the extent that's an important part of the project, you know, to sketch out the full range of rights, the character of these different types of rights, I think it's a useful way to approach it. My sense is that there's a much more basic misunderstanding right now in current American culture at a much more basic level, which is just a misunderstanding about the wide range of protections which these systems of rights give, the very different types of protections that they give, and an appreciation of those differences.
Okay, and so what you really want to focus on are the different kinds of protections that may come with different kinds of rights with regards to different kinds of objects.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Maybe be helpful to give a couple of examples, and maybe some general examples initially, and then later on the show I want to talk about some concerning cyber law, which I know is your specialty.
Well, at the extreme, there are kinds of property where an individual's right to control that property and rights over that property is at its extreme, or is most strong. And here you can think about the law's traditional protection for personal diaries or objects within the home, or the home itself, where by the state or by others is at its highest. So if the police want to search your house, unlike your car, they have to go and get a search warrant before they can enter the house. and certain objects historically, although not so much today, like diaries, have been especially strongly protected against invasion by the police, for example, as they would want to collect evidence about possible crimes. But as you move away from this place, the home, to, for example, the car or other objects that you might have in, you know, your general dealings on the street with other people or other objects that might affect other people more directly, the interest that the state has in regulating your use of this property increases. So your car is a heavily regulated piece of property. The state, you know, makes sure that it's safe. The state licenses it. You have to carry a tag on your car that identifies you or identifies who it's registered to. Again, the police can search it much more easily. It's much less expectation of privacy that's associated with it. And that goes with what's reasonable about the car's relationship to other important state interests. Now, one way to understand the difference here is just what is the likelihood that your use of the particular property at issue will affect other people in a harmful way? So if the likelihood is high, if it's a large probability that the use of this property will affect other people, then the state's interest in investigating and regulating that property will be greater. But if it's low, you know, what I write in my diary or what goes on in my own house, nobody really has any concern about or should probably have any concern about. And so that's an example of the state's interest being very weak.
Okay, so if someone says, well, look, all things ought to be the same. I own my house. I own my car. The state ought to treat them exactly the same. Your response is, no, they shouldn't, because what you do in your house, for the most part, is less. It's at least less likely to negatively affect others than what you do in your car.
Yeah, I mean, I think the mistake that leads to people thinking in this singular way about property is really to discount the function of the state here. I mean, the function of the state is to intervene in the lives of individuals where what those individuals do will wrongfully harm other people. So if what I'm doing doesn't affect anybody else, then in the traditional liberal state, the state has very little reason to want to or has very little justification for intervening in my life. On the other hand, if what I do will harm other people, either because I pollute the stream or because I create a dangerous circumstance or because I'm likely to cause harm as I'm driving down the highway, any of those possible harmful effects to other people creates an interest in the state in trying to regulate to make sure I don't cause those harmful effects.
Okay, you've talked a bit about the way in which the range of protections is a language you've used a couple times that may accompany a certain objects, like our house, like our car. But at the same time, you've also talked about regulations on it, which I suppose are ways in which limitations on the protections might be one way of understanding what a regulation or a constraint is.
Yeah.
In one of your papers, I thought it was most interesting, you talk about four different ways, or the language I think you use there, modalities in which a behavior or an action can be regulated or controlled or constrained. I think it might be helpful to distinguish those four for mm-hmm. the listener.
Well, I mean, lawyers like to think a lot about the way that law regulates behavior and likes to think of law as the only regulator of behavior. And certainly, law is a very important regulator. So when the state says that I can only drive at 65 miles per hour, what the state does is say that if I drive more than 65 miles per hour, they will punish me if they catch me. And so that certainly is has an effect in regulating my behavior just because of my, at least because of my fear of being caught and punished by the state. But anybody except a lawyer, I think, quickly sees that other things regulate behavior beyond the law. So social norms are an important source of regulatory constraint that in many contexts is quite helpful in making a community function in a proper, you know, proper way to ensure that people keep their promises or they behave in a way that the community believes is important. But sometimes, of course, social norms can be harmful to a community. So norms about segregation were harmful in the South of America, South of the United States, and norms in England in the middle part of the 19th century stifled critical speech and critical thought just because it was a very strong tendency to force people to conform to the standard set of views. So norms are a regulator. They can be good, just like any regulator. It can be good or bad, but they function differently from the way law functions. Law regulates by threatening a punishment that's imposed by a state, and norms regulate by threatening a punishment that's imposed, if it's imposed at all, by the community within which people live. Now, in addition to norms, you can think about the way the market regulates. The market doesn't punish you. The market basically says if you want to get access to some resource, then you must pay a certain price, and the price goes up or down depending upon supply and demand in the market. So it constrains by a system of pricing that gets imposed by either central actors in a non-free market or by the market itself in a free market. And it constrains people and changes their behavior, but not through a system of punishment, just by basically conditioning the way they can play the economic game. And finally, I think the form of regulation that's least thought about, but I think has historically been extremely important, is architecture as a kind of regulator. So, for example, Louis Napoleon III in Paris rebuilt the city of Paris to create wide boulevards. And one reason he did this was to make sure that the revolutionaries in Paris would not be able to blockade the city by taking advantage of very small, narrow streets. So he's rebuilding the architecture of the city to make it easier or make it harder for people to be revolutionaries, and using the architecture then to regulate behavior more easily. In the United States, Madison described the layout of the United States, this dispersed geography, in part as conducive to a very strong democracy, because it would be very hard for factions to organize across very large geographical distances and take over government and change it into a factional government. In the United States, in New York, Robert Moses was a city planner who designed the bridges on Long Island so that buses could not pass under some of those bridges and therefore could not easily get to certain beaches. And the clear intent of this was to make sure that those who needed to ride the bus didn't go to some beaches, and those who had cars did get to go to those beaches. And the way income distribution was, and unfortunately still is, what that meant was that black or African Americans would not go to some beaches and would have to go to other beaches, and white Americans would go to those beaches that you could get to by cars. Now, there was the use of architecture to regulate, to enforce a kind of segregation in the community. Now, architecture regulates differently from the way law regulates, regulates differently from the way norms regulate, regulates differently from the way markets regulate, but the important thing is to think about how all of them work together in particular contexts, or how they can work at odds, and also how sometimes law can act to change these other forms of regulation. So the law can be used to help change social norms, as it was used in the South to help change norms about segregation. It can be used to affect the market by taxing certain activities or by subsidizing other activities. and it can be used to change the constraints of architecture. You know, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which requires buildings to be built to make access available to people with disabilities, is an obvious example, but there are many other examples about how the state attempts to physically structure a community to make sure that people behave in a certain way, or make it hard for people to behave in a way which is counter to the state's objectives.
Okay, there are a couple things I'd like to get clear before we begin to move into some of the more cyber issues. One of the points you make, you talk about the four different ways in which behavior can be constrained or regulated. And you did point out, I mean, obviously law is something that's done by the government. The other three forms, as you pointed out at the end there, can be used by the government to regulate behavior indirectly. But it's all, what seems also clear is that some forms of regulation and constraint are not governmental at all. That choices businesses make or individuals make can constrain behavior as well. Is that correct?
It is, although I'm less and less convinced that it's useful to try to think of examples where one can say the government doesn't have any role at all. I mean, think about the market. People like to talk about the free market, free of government regulation. But the market only exists because there are property rights, and property only exists because the government has defined what is property and will enforce violations of property rights. The market only exists because there's contracts, and contracts exist because the government will enforce promises that are presented with adequate consideration. The market functions largely in a stable way because you have a stable currency. Again, the government's providing the currency. So in the market, you know, in some sense you can say the government's not doing anything when you have a perfectly free market, but it's not ultimately the case that the government's doing nothing, because the government has been responsible in good cases for setting up an effective and well-structured market. And the same thing with social norms. Certainly, in many contexts, the government has nothing to do with certain kinds of social norms. So, the way teenagers dress, I doubt that the government has anything to do with that. But the government does very much attempt to regulate the way people think about smoking. In the United States, we're very, very proud of this, but we're very strongly opposed to smoking in public places or in places where it affects other people. And a large part of the reason why we have that view, different from other people in the world, is the government's longstanding campaign to get people to view smoking as a disfavored activity. We could have in each of these cases an argument about how much of the regulation is because of government or not because of government. And I'm happy to say that it's not all because of government, but I think it's not true to say that there are many areas of our life that are completely unaffected by what government has done.
Okay, so government either enables or permits, or sometimes government can directly set up a regulation. Uh-huh. Other times it can indirectly support other ways in which behavior is regulated.
Right.
Okay. All right, let's move into the areas of which you're really primarily interested in concerning the Internet. I know and various cyber issues are of primary concern to you. And certainly one issue that you've written a great deal about is the issue of privacy. Maybe it'd be helpful to begin by, before we start talking about the privacy in the Internet, talk a little bit about privacy on something like a telephone to illustrate what we mean by privacy, the kinds of constraints that there may be on both what you can do on the telephone and what others can do to listen to what you do in the telephone.
Well, sure. One problem with the word privacy is that we use it to think about lots of very different ideas, and that's confusing many times in trying to figure out how to apply privacy in cyberspace. I think of two different senses to the word privacy that become important in cyberspace, and in particular in relation to an example like the telephone. One sense of privacy is freedom from intrusion by others into you know, either conversations or facts about people that you don't want others to know. So this is the idea of, like, privacy of the home, where other people aren't supposed to look in your window or come into your house or rummage through your property. And a different sense of privacy, one that's increasingly important in cyberspace, is control over the use of data about you that others come to get. So, for example, when you sign up on a web page and you give them all this information about yourself, there's an informational privacy concerns. Ask the question, well, what can they do with that data? Can they give it to others? Can they sell it to others? Can they use it to track you down or to monitor your behavior, whatever? Now, those are two very different issues. And in the history of telephones, you've seen both issues become important at different times. In the beginning, telephone companies worked very hard to convince their customers that privacy on the telephone line would be respected. There's lots of stories initially about telephone switching systems where operators had to switch the telephone calls, and operators would spend lots of time listening to telephone conversations, and that would make it people unwilling to use the telephone. So the companies had to work to try to create an impression of privacy. And what that meant was give people the sense that they weren't going to be listened to as they have these telephone conversations. Early on, the government then decided that there would be times that the government wanted to tap telephones. And the telephone companies at first resisted this because, again, they were trying to create the impression that telephones were safe. But slowly, courts would force telephone companies to allow their wires to be tapped. There's a very famous series of cases in the United States where the question was, if the government taps a telephone, is that a violation of the Fourth Amendment right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures? And in an early case, 1920, is a case by the name of Olmsted, the Supreme Court said that wiretapping a telephone was not a search, and so the government was not constrained in its ability to tap telephones. Now, there's a very famous dissent from that case, a dissent by Justice Brandeis. Justice Brandeis said that even though the technical terms of the Fourth Amendment might not apply to a telephone, which is not really an individual's property, or the telephone lines aren't necessarily somebody's property, and so tapping the telephone lines is not necessarily invading somebody's property. Justice Brandeis said we ought to interpret the amendment to allow it to protect the kinds of areas of privacy that the framers of our Constitution were clearly trying to protect. So he would have found wiretapping to be a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It took about 40 years, but in 1968, the Supreme Court finally decided that the Fourth Amendment would protect against wiretapping. And so from that point on, if the government wants to tap into your telephone call, there are very strict procedures it must pass in order to invade that private space. Now, that's privacy in the sense of avoiding invasion of your private space, but there's another sense of privacy here, which is data about you. Now, the original telephone calls, when you made a telephone call, there's very little that the system knew about you because it didn't really know where you were. It didn't have an efficient way for collecting information about what numbers you dialed and so on and so forth. But as telephone systems have become much smarter, lots of information about you is collected. So the numbers you call, how long you stay on the telephone line, from where you call, the frequency, all this kind of information becomes collected. And this identification information then becomes useful for marketers or the government, really, to know what kind of, to monitor your behavior. Now, that's not really listening to your telephone calls, so it's not invading your privacy in that sense, but it is using information about you that you might not intend for other people to use or to have. And you might not intend it, even though in some very trivial sense, you've made it publicly available because you've dialed the telephone number on a public telephone system, so you've publicly released this information. Now, lots of concern has developed about what telephone companies can do with this data, and there are pretty important protections on what telephone companies can do with this data. But that's just the first instance of the kind of problem that cyberspace presents generally, where everything you do in cyberspace produces data, which the websites and the servers and the system in general can collect, and the very important question about what they can do with it, what they can do about selling it to other people or making it available to others or facilitating the monitoring of stuff that you do.
All right, let me ask you then, and one of the concerns that I take it is how is that going to be controlled, or should it be controlled? I mean, as you pointed out with the telephone, there's a sense in which you could avoid all this. You could simply not get on the Internet. The question is whether it's a reasonable demand to say, if you sign up on the Internet or if you log onto the Internet, you're giving someone permission to use this information. In the next, we've got just about 3 minutes left here, 2.5, 3 minutes. What's your solution here? What's your view on what we ought to do about privacy on the Internet?
Well, I think that the key thing is to see that much of the problem with privacy in the Internet is now created because the architecture of the Internet facilitates the collection and monitoring of behavior by people in the Internet. So the source of the problem is the architecture. Now, we could have a different architecture that would facilitate greater control by individuals over the data that's used, data about them or the collection of data about them, either through strengthening systems for creating anonymity or by strengthening systems where people can exercise control over what use is made of data about them. And so, in my view, the important thing here is to create incentives for the market to produce technologies that facilitate individual control over the use of data about them. And I think the government has an important role here in trying to create those incentives by either directly regulating or indirectly regulating to create that kind of market in the kind of reaction by the market to help them, people facilitate better control over data about them.
So the best way for the government to protect privacy is actually indirectly.
Right, by creating incentives for the market to produce technologies so that those technologies will better protect privacy.
And this is the very sort of interaction we were talking about earlier between what private companies do and what the government does.
Right, there's an interaction here, and the smart thing is to understand how the these different things work together rather than thinking simply about just what the government can do or just what companies will do independent of the government.
Okay, would you like to take the last sort of 45 seconds and sum up any last important points you'd like to make for the listener?
Well, I think the hardest thing to do in cyberspace is to open our perspective up to the different ways in which law and technology interact. And people who focus only on law or focus only on technology are going to miss this interaction and therefore not be able to protect interests or values that we think of are as important, in particular here, the value of privacy.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Sure.
I've been speaking today with Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Stanford University, and our topic has been forms of property. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.